beams, you know, to be in like, it was made like an old sled, you know. Only back in them days, it was pins made out of wood, and some of them was made out of iron. But anyway, I got these 8-inch bolts, put them in, and of course, to put them up through the bottom, up through and into the rave, and this particular, and my dad wanted I should into this display down there, because he says you made it. I want you to take it down. So I did, and the principal, not the principal, but the ag teacher there, he was there. Now, I can remember there was Ed Jones, fellow by the name of Ed Jones, and he's the only one I can remember now. But there was three judges, and they were all farmers. And, of course, the ag teacher there had the boys made different things, you know, book racks and bookcases and whatnot. And so they were all on display. Well, when they come to my sled, and of course at the bottom of my sled, I'd put just less than half inch for the bottom, you know, to lay on there. And of course, I hadn't done a very good job to have them smooth, you know, across like this, so they'd fit tight. But there's crack there. But anyway, they judged my sled, and the judges says, well, I think this one should be the first. And the principal, not the principal, but this ag teacher says, no, he says, the reason I don't think it should is the bolts should be turned down so the nut would be down on the bottom. And I can see those judges' heads going like that, but that didn't make any difference. I mean, they went along. They gave me the second place, as I remember it. But I could see them judges today doing that. But my dad was always encouraging me to do things. And when I was growing up as a small boy there, I was always making carts and birdhouses and things like that. And he was always coaching me to take my spending money and buy tools, which that's what I did. And I can remember going to Montpelier. There was a fellow used to, he had Model T, and his name was Rob Livingston. No, not Rob. His name was Livingston. And you'd call him up if you wanted to go to Montpelier and say, I'd like to ride Montpelier. Okay, be down at such a place at 8 o'clock. That's the time he'd go. He'd take people out and do a dollar, I believe, for a ride to Montpelier and back again. Back in them days, was a dollar. But I can remember going, and the driver of the old Ford was, behind the wheel. I sat in the middle. Another man sat on the other side. And then the back seat, I think it was 3-4 people in it. Well, anyway, I went out. My dad says to the fellow that was driving the car, he says, go in with Everett and help him pick out some tools. So I did. I went into this hardware store out there, and first thing I picked out was a hammer. And I picked me out a saw. And then I picked out some bits, small sizes, from quarter inch up to about an inch. And then I bought a little plane and we'd had We'd had carpenters up there building the porch, and he always had one of these little hand axes, a good deal like a little small axe, but anyway, I bought one of them because I could see this carpenter over here having one, so I had to have one of them. Well, I came home, and I got a square and a bit stock, and Dad was so pleased with my purchase. And he said, I guess we'll let you go again someday, but we didn't have to. But anyway, to this day, I've got the square and the saw and some of the bits and the bit stock. And I think that's the old little hand axe. It was about that long, the handle was about that long. That, I can't remember what happened to that. I can't remember. And my sled that my dad helped me make for the steers, and that went away with the flood, because we was living there in the village where the Matique girls are there, and the sled was undercover down under the barn, and the water come up so high that the sled went away, and I never see it after that. No. But he was always coaching me to save my money for tools. And so when I got ready to build this house, I couldn't visualize anything on paper. So I made me a model. And I bought me a bench saw. And then I was having my lumber sawed for this house, and spruce, and hemlock. And so this particular night, I says to Catherine, I said, we can't visualize anything on paper. So I says, I'm going to make me a model. And I made this house from that model. And this represents is 60 feet long, and it's 30 feet wide. So I had to build it up on legs, you know, so that we could sit and work on it. And we built that house from that model. Well, I took and knew just how many two by four, the floor joists and all those, and the roof and the rafters. I knew just how many it was going to take from that model. And when I was cutting the logs for it, I started in October. I'd take a little book with me, and I had a measure. I'd measure them, I'd cut this tree, and I'd go through it. Well, I says, this will make perhaps 3 10-by-10s, 2-by-10s, I would say, and 2-by-6 and 2-by-4. Well, anyway, and I got that all sawed, and I had it brought home stacked, then I took it down to Granville to have a man plane it for me. He played it on all four sides, so it was just like bought in lumber, only smaller. The boards I used was, well, an 8-inch board or 6 or whatever. And I built this house from that. And it was Mr. Gallagher there, he was the one that used to sell the nails and so forth. And he said that a house never blow down with all the nails you bought. Well, I said, I don't intend it to. But anyway, when we got ready to build it, I let the foundation out, cement job out to Anderson over to Waterbury. And they come in and put that up. And then I started in building this house. And this particular Sunday, my brother-in-law from over the other side of the mountain married Catherine's sister, and my brother and his wife from Randolph, they happened to come over at the house to have dinner that particular day. And so we just got the cement poured on this house. So I says to my brother-in-law, Gordon, I said, how do you line up this sail plank that goes on top of the cement, you know, with the bolts sticking up through? I said, how do you put those planks on and get them right so they're going? Well, he says, I'll show you the way I do it after dinner. So after dinner, we came over, and brother and he and I, we put on that row of plank along that side of that. And from that day on, either a Saturday or a Sunday, he and his wife come over, and he would help me. Well, like when we begun to put up the sidewalls, you know, and he made a bracket for me so that two befores would all be the same length, and he showed me how to put the excuse me how to put the different lengths of wood into this cradle that he'd made to so that they all be there. And by golly, from that Sunday on, either he and his wife came over on a Saturday or a Sunday, and he'd say, well, come in the day. Well, he says, I guess I've got enough lined up for you for another week. And I wouldn't have had the house that I've got now if he hadn't had, although I did know pretty much what I was trying to do. When I got my lumber all sawed and everything, I had plenty of everything, a little bit of everything left over. But that's how I built this house. And I used to call him my teacher. And he says, well, you're a pretty good scholar too. So that's the way we built this house. And so far it's stayed up.
Looks like it's here to
Then, of course, the finishing part here, I had to buy, but the main part of the house, the floors and the sidewalls and the roof and all that was made out of my own lumber that I cut here on my own farm. But the finishing there, of course, I had to all buy, but it saved me quite a few dollars. I didn't know how much it really cost me, but I can't think of it today, but saved me a good many dollars.
One other story you told me was about your father and about a horse he had, and then eventually that was the horse I think.
Yeah, he used to raise colts, you know. He'd turn them out on Parma Hill in the spring. Somebody else have a colt they'd want to turn into, so, because one colt wouldn't stay alone. They'd jump out and get out. They always had to have two, three colts. Same with cattle, too. You'd got to have more than one or they wouldn't stay in the pasture. But anyway, he'd got this horse. It was a gray one, colt.
Did you want some water?
I could drink some.
Story
I wanted to tell about myself.
Great. I want you
okay,
to.
Okay, we're rolling.
Were you all set?
Yeah.
Okay, we were back with your father racing the.
Yeah, horses. Well, he was trying to get a team together. He'd had an old horse, his name was Ned, and he'd raised him up as a colt. And I forgot what the other horse was that he had sight of him, but Old Ned and Old Jim was his favorite horses. Well, Old Ned, I can hear my dad had sent a hired man to Montpelier with a load of, he butchered his hogs off. He had, I'd say probably six or eight, you know, and that was another income that a farmer would raise. He'd raise two spring and fall, a litter of pigs, and he'd raise them up to, butchering age. But anyway, he sent he'd butchered, and he'd sent this hired man to Montpelier, and he was to stay overnight and then come back the next day. Well, old Ned, he had a case of colic, and the only way that he could get him relief would to take him out and walk him. Well, he come down with a hired man, called my dad from Montpelier, and said, old Ned is sick. Well, what should I do? Well, he said, you take him, walk him around, and he'll be all right in a little while. And he did. Well, no, he kept that horse till he couldn't get up in the morning, or he couldn't get up, you know. So he had a neighbor come in, and he waited till after we boys had gone to bed. He had him taken care of. And then there came this old Jim horse. He was a bigger horse, and he'd raised him up as a colt, and that was his favorite horse.
All right, since you got to see a shaking head. Can you start with the Jim horse?
Yeah, okay.
No? Well,
back further. There's perhaps Mr. Paul.
With a fellow called from Montpelier.
Yeah, from one of the fellow called from Montpelier again, because there's several coughs.
The fellow called from Montpelier.
Yeah, and told my dad, he said, old Jim is sick. What should I do? He said, well, you just take him out and walk him around for a while, and he'll come right out of that spell, which he did. And then the next day he came home. But anyway, my dad was trying to get another young team started, and he'd raised this Jim horse as a colt. And I can see him today going up with my dad to salt the cattle and the horses on this particular day. And he'd holler, come boss, come boss. And they'd hear him, and they'd come from over across the way. So there's a brook over there. They'd been over to drink. And this old Jim horse, colt, he was right up there. He was coming right out through, running like a dickens. He'd lead the whole session. Right? Anyway, he was my dad's pride and joy. So, and he lived, and then he'd bought another gray horse later on. When he used to be a lister. And when he was out listening, he saw one of the farmers had this gray horse, a gray colt. So my dad says, well, you wouldn't sell him, would you? And sure. So he bought that gray horse to go with this Jim horse. And brought him home, and they'd run away with a drop of the hat because they were young. But anyway, we kept that old Jim horse after my dad passed away. We kept that old Jim horse as long as he lived. And I was fixing fence up here in the spring of the year, and I'd driven a fence post in, and I had this Jim horse hitched to a wagon, one horse wagon. And I drove my post and was just getting ready to staple the wares on, and old Jim fell down in the shafts. So I said, well, you're all right, lay there. So I finished doing my work, nailing the wire onto the post. So I went along when I got that done, and I took hold of the rein to his bridle. I says, come on, Jim, let's get up. Old Jim didn't get up. Evidently he'd had a heart attack or something. He died right there. Well, I went down to the house and told my mother, and she said, well, what are you going to do? Well, I said, I'm going to give old Jim a good burial. I said, that's what my dad would want. So I did. I took the other horse and brought him over here on the side here, and I dug a good big grave, and I put him in it. Also, two other horses that I had in my lifetime that had died natural death. and I buried them. But I know my dad appreciated it.
Now, was Jim the horse that ran away with your dad? Is that?
Oh, yeah, he and that other gray one.
Tell me that one, because you and your brother were involved.
Yeah, well, we were living at the village at that time. He'd sold the farm. Then he had to take the farm back because he couldn't pay for it. So the cows, it was in, it was after haying, and pastures was getting short. Excuse me. And so he wanted to come up to hell, and he wasn't too good. I mean, he was having problems. So Dwight and I came up with a little driving horse, and we was working around the farm here doing something, I forgot now what. Anyway, my dad came up, but he came up with the gray horses, hitched on the mowing machine. What he was doing, he was mowing grass around the fence, because the cows would stick their head through the fence and was eating that good grass, green grass. So my dad was going to mow that hay that had got up, probably so high. And then he was going to spread a load of manure all along so they wouldn't crowd the fence. So on this day he was mowing, we heard him holler. And he was way up here next to the woods. And them horses was running away. And there was a water bar right up just above the house. I'm looking about where it was. And when he went over that water bar.
Well, is that a, yeah. Start back again, I'll move the lamp. there was a water bar.
Yeah, there was a water bar right up here just about where I'm looking now. And it was quite deep. Well, when he went over that water bar with the mowing machine, that mowing machine bar was cutting grass just like this, all going back and forth. And when he went over that water bar, he got thrown off the mowing machine. He was dragging under the mowing machine. And brother and I was in the high horse barn doors there. And you see him coming. And I run out, there was a fence coming both ways and a gate here. And luckily it was wide enough so that the mowing machine went through. So we run out there and I grabbed the fence post. And just as they went by, I swung all my might. And it stopped them enough, slowed them enough so they run into the horse barn. Instead of going down the road. Oh, I hit it again.
Just back up to coming through.
Grab the fence post.
Start with grabbing the fence post.
Well, I grabbed the fence post, and then I swung it with all my might across their nostrils, in the head. And it slowed them up enough so they run into the horse barn instead of going down the road. Of course, the mowing machine was left outside the door because when they went in with such speed that they did, they broke the harnesses and the whippletries and everything. But if they'd ever gone down the road, nobody knows what would have happened. There might have been somebody terribly hurt or something. And that's when he was living in the village. But he never got up. He never got out after that. And he died in mother can tell you, but I can't, in September, I remember. Yeah.
Do you mind just backing up a hair? Because you and your brother were young boys.
Oh, yeah, we were just small boys.
If you could say, my brother and I, and we were...
Well, my brother and I was in the horse barn, and I don't know what we were doing, but we heard him hollering from way up in the woods, up near the woods. And as they came, there was a kind of a corner the road, you know. And when they come around the corner, we knew they were, them horses were right in a dead run. And of course, he was hanging on to the reins, trying to stop them, but he couldn't hold them. And when he went over that water bar, it threw him off. And he was dragging in under the mowing machine, and that cutter bar was going just as fast as it could go. But my brother and I know I was the one that run there, and there used to be an old pile of old fence posts, you know. I don't know, I just grabbed one that I could swing, and I picked it up, and when they went by, I swung it for all my might, because if I'd been on the other side, then I'd get cut with the mowing machine. But I was on this side of the horse. I think it was on old Jim's side. I know it was. And anyway, they run into the horse barn, which was the old horse. Of course, they used to live over there anyway, but after he'd sold the farm, went down to the village. But they'd always lived here, and so they was... That's all I knew enough to do, I guess, was to go. And when they went into the barn door, of course, the barn door wasn't big enough to take the mowing machine and them. Dwight and I got him out from under the mowing machine, and took him home, and he never got out of bed after that. And then, and I never knew it until just a few years ago. There was a boy that didn't have any home, and he was had been living in Middlesex, and he wanted to go to high school. So he came up to Wastefield, and he was another farmer up on Route 100 there. Said, "Well, I can use the boy to help me here." Well, he went there, and of course he and I got to be quite friendly at school, and he was telling me, the man was kind of abusing him, you know, in a way that things weren't right. He was asking him to do things that he shouldn't have been doing there on the farm. And so I came home and I told my dad about it. Well, he said, "Everett," he said, "tell him to come up to the house." He come up to the house, and Dad says, "How would you like to come live with me?" He says, "We've got Everett here and his brother." Well, he says, "I'd like it." Well, he did. And but on his dying, just before he died, he says to my mother, he says, "Write Willis a letter or call him." He was working in Burlington then. "And tell him to come home, that I want to see him." And he did. He came home. And Dad called him into his bedroom. And he said, "Willis, I'd like to have you come and live with Della," that was my dad's wife's name, Della, "and the little boys." He says, try and get along. Don't have any squabbles. Try and get along. You're the oldest. Try and get along." And he did. And he lived with us till he got through school, high school. And then I went over to Aggie School over to Randolph, and he went too. And after graduation, he went his way and I came home. But I never knew that until, it was just a few years ago, Willis wrote me a letter. And he said, "I want to tell you what your dad told me." I just couldn't believe it. But my dad had took that boy in, and he liked the boy, and that's the way that worked. And we've been, He writes to us, and we call one another on the phone. He's still living. He's 80. I think he's 88. And I'm 86 now. I'll be 87 in May. But anyway, I never knew it until just a few years back. He wrote me a letter and told me all about it. My dad told Willis, he said, I know I'm not going to get out of bed. But he said, I'd like to have you come and live with Della and the boys. And he did, and he stayed. We carried on. We had 10 cows. My dad had moved to the village. After he got to the village, he was homesick for land. So we went up in Ayersville. There was 14 acres of land for sale up there. He bought it. He paid $2,000 for it. And folks thought he'd gone crazy to pay that much money for that 14 acres of land. But he wanted it. And then he had the hay to feed to them cows. But after he moved to the village, I can hear him telling his cousin that came out to visit him on noon hour, it was dinner time. And he says, you know, I forget what his name was. Well, anyway, he called him a name. He says, you know, he says, I had to do this, because he says, I had to keep them boys out of the village. They was out on the street. He says, I had to do something to keep them boys out of the village. And I knew this was the only way to do it, was to have a few cows down here for them to help take care of. And we did. We had. And my dad and my mother used to sell milk. And she knew the pails. They'd bring their pail, you know. They had two pails. And she knew everybody's pail, and she'd put, if they wanted a quart every day, well, she'd put a quart in, and a cupful. She always put an extra cupful in, so they'd have a good full quart, and they all appreciated that. But anyway, she had this kitchen table. It was longer than that table there, and it was just covered with different pails, and people would come right there to the house at night and pick up their pail, and then once a month they'd come pay the bill. And what milk wasn't sold that way was separated and then took to down at the creamery. But that's, and then for after my dad died, we kept them barn full of cattle. And, oh, I was so out of fix. It'd come fall, November. We'd taken all the cattle, cows that we could put in the barn down there. Because Dad had been buying cows and was going to stock up this barn out here. And I suppose he was going to come up here and do chores. I don't know. I guess that's probably what he had in mind. But anyway, I'd taken down all the cattle that we could put in there in the barn. And they had the three horses. And we had 10 head of cattle left up here, out in the field. And it was the first snowstorm we'd had back in last October, first November, I forget which, but it wasn't much snow. But anyway, cattle were down here at the corner right out here where the gate used to be, and they wanted to get undercover. So this man up in East Warren, and this Walter Jones that I'm talking about, he was my dad's administrator. So this fella up in East Warren went into the store and he says, Walter, he says, what are you going to do with these extra cattle that's up here. Well, he says, I guess we got to sell them. Well, I didn't know it until after. But anyway, he sold, there was 14 head, as I remember. And he sold that 14 head of cattle for $100. That's what the fella up in East Warren offered him. And I was so upset to think that the man took advantage, that I says, I'll get even with you someday, and I did. I did. I'm going to tell you what I did. We wanted to put in a furnace. My dad had put in a wood-fired furnace down cellar in the house down there. It was a one-pipe furnace to blow the hot air up. So when we come back up here at the farm, we moved back up here at the farm after I'd got through school. And I said, we've got to have a furnace down cellar, Mother. She says, yes, we should have. I said, all right, I'm going to get even with this man up in East Warren. He was the one to sell in the furnaces. I called him up and I says, I'd like to buy a furnace, put it in down cellar. He says, okay. I come down and measure up and see how big it was. And he says, yeah. I says, yeah, I've got a cow I want to trade in. And the cow, she had aborted. And I didn't want her in with the rest of them. So she was in the horse barn up there. And I learned it from another good friend. I took and blew this bag on that cow up, and she was a beautiful looking calf. I had another calf down at the barn that I was, well, it was a little bull calf, and I wasn't going to keep it anyway. And I had him up there. He come in, and I said, I want to sell you this cow. I told you on the phone I wanted to sell you a cow. She says, the calf was with her and she had a good big bag. I guess I hit it again.
Yeah, they're nodding. Okay, let's start with, you blew up.
Yeah, I did this with one other good friend of mine did that. I blew up that bag so she looked good. Yeah. And.
Would you mind, because people won't understand. You better say I blew up the bag with what, a bicycle pump?
Yeah, yeah. I had a if a cow got a tit stepped on or something like that, they had a little vial that they would put in the end of the tit, you know, and then put this pump on the end of it. So that's what I did. I blowed up this cow's udder. So, oh, she had a good bag. She had a good bag. And I sold the cow for a good price. And he agreed on it and took the cow away. But I didn't tell him. But he bought the furnace and delivered it, and he took the cow at the time he delivered the furnace. The deal was square. We traded the cow for the furnace. But I told Mother at the time, I'll get even with him. It's the last thing I know. And I did.
That is just a wonderful story. I've never heard that. That's wonderful. And you didn't know it? Your wife didn't know it.
Well,
should I believe it?
Some things I haven't told her. But we've sat here some nights and I've told her things. There's another incident I want to tell you that just happened just yesterday, the day before. I see one of my class for when we were growing up in school, first grade, out to the wayside. By golly, I run into him yesterday, day before, And he was, I'd finished my dinner and he was just getting ready to have his. And anyway, he got up and we come over and shook hands and talked, put a hand on each other's shoulder. I says, his name was Earl, too. And I said, Earl, I says, I remember your sister. She was one of them. Of the, I don't know how many it was in the class, 7 or 8 probably. I don't know, 6. I can't remember. But it was Leighton Leno. Remember him, and myself, and this lady Long. And it was probably Gerald Martin, I think. But the other one or two I can't remember now, and he couldn't yesterday, or day before. And I says, you know, we were standing up in front of the blackboard, and all of a sudden the teacher come out and grabbed him by the shirt collar, took him out into the cloakroom, and she had a rubber hose about that long. She went to her desk, got that rubber hose, whang, whang, whang. You could hear her giving that to him. And from then on, I was so scared that my school days was ruined. And that's, I want a good school, a scholar in school from then on, because I was scared to death. And I couldn't remember the teacher's name, but he says, yes, he says, that was Mrs. Huntley. I said, God, that's right. I says, I remember now, but I couldn't remember her name. Then he went on to tell another incident where he says the teacher wouldn't believe me, but he says, I want to blame. I was defending myself. And she says, oh, she says she gave me an awful clobbering with a rubber hose. And I said, I've laughed about it, and I've told Callan and I both have laughed about it. And there we was, hadn't seen anybody for a long time. And then we met out to the wayside the other day. Those things, I have laughed about it so many times since then. Just back in them days. Well, I wasn't, from then on, I wanted a good scholar. And I begged my mother and dad to let me go to this little one-room school up here on the corner. It was a mile up here, but the way they divided it, we went to the village school, and from our place above, they went to that one-room schoolhouse. And I, all that time, I was begging my people, my folks, to, if I couldn't go back up there, but no. But I never, I hated school. I hated it. And that's what's caused it. But today, you know, they wouldn't allow that.
Was that Earl Long?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I interviewed him too, and I'm going to try and get him to do this as well.
Well, you ask him about this.
I will.
You ask him if he remembers talking, and by I laugh more about it. Because I've tried to think of that school teacher. Well, Catherine says to me the other night, I was telling her about some of these things, and she says, what school teacher did you like? But there was one that I really did, and she helped me a lot. But I presume she's passed on now, but at the time she was a single girl. But she helped me. It was in the, I guess it was in the 6th grade that when she came into the teach there in the valley down here to school, and I was in the 6th grade as I remember. But she really did a lot for me. That I liked that girl, that woman. And I can remember I was going over to the Aggie school at that time. It was after I got through school. And she came to town to visit people across the road from down there where the teddy bear store is there. And she seen me. So she she called up and says, every one of you going back to Randolph. Well, this is this afternoon sometime, this late afternoon. Well, she says, I wonder if I could ride. And I can't remember where I left her off, whether it was Montpelier or where it was, but I said, sure. Well, then she went on to tell she was boarding with some place, and one of the boys, young man, was going over to the Aggie School with me. And he told her, he says, you know, Palmer, on to some mathematic problem or something, and she says Palmer was the one that had the top honor on that. And so she says to me, she says, Everett, she says, I believe I helped you when I was in town. I said, I know you did, but I had a lot of respect for you. But she went on to, she says, now you take this little advice from me. She says, you watch that professor. You just watch him and find out through his talking just what he is putting across to you, and you'll make out all right. And I did. Then another time I can remember, we was out to the barn, and we had the judge. He'd had four cows, as I remember it, and we had to place them. 1, 2, 3, 4. And by God, Everett Palmer was the one that placed them right. But I took that advice from her as she told me that fall, going from here to Montpelier for somewhere. But I never forgot that. I've told Karen about it a lot of times. She was a good teacher. I liked her.
Now, how did you place those cows right? What were you looking
at? Well, it was further, just like they do at the fairs or anything. They had to have a straight back and their necks was, and they had to have the veins, milk veins, had to have good deep milk veins, good chest, plenty of room for roughage and all sorts of. It wasn't squashed right up together. They had a good built dairy cattle. It looks, a dairy cow looks like a wedge. It looks like a wedge to look at it. You know, that's one way they're telling it. It looks a wedge. You don't want one that looks perfectly straight under the belly, across their back. That's more like a beef animal. But a good dairy cow, it's got a good barrel on it, good milk veins, plenty of heart girth they talked about, and a pleasant-looking head. But I just loved going over there to Aggie School. And from there, I remember we was taking our final exams in June, and there was a fella from, his name was Duffy from Connecticut. And he came up to school there, and he went into the office, and he says to Mr. Judge, he was the principal, he says, I come up, I want to hire a good dairy boy. Well, he says, I got one that I'll bring into it. So he came to the door and said, I'd like to see Mr. Palmer. And God, I began to get scared because I didn't know what I'd done. Well, anyway, I went into the office, and there stood this man. And he says, I've come up from Connecticut, and I want to hire a good Vermont boy. And Mr. Judge gave me a good recommendation. And from there, after graduation, I went down there and I worked. I was down there about a year. And then he was taken sick and died, so then I came home. And another thing that I did, the foreman down there, he was, after the man had died, I stayed, I don't know, probably 2-3 months after he died or something, but he was putting everything all over this widow. And I stood it as long as I could. He was selling cattle out of the barn, unbeknown to her, putting it in his pocket. They was registered cattle. And finally, oh, I don't know, a week or 10 days before I left, I went to her one night after, it was after dark and the other men had gone home. I went to the door and rapped. She came to the door and I says, Mrs. Duffy, I'd like to come in and talk with you a minute. And I told her. And she thanked me very preciously. And after, on our wedding trip, I took Catherine down there and we stayed overnight with that widow.
Did you tell her about the bicycle pump and how you got back?
No,
and
the grain to this Duffy would make up a grain menu, you know, like what the farmer, like what he wanted his cows fed. Well, this foreman there, he had another fella working there that was mixing the grain. And he was putting in too much cottonseed. And it was making poor milk. By that I mean they was having mastitis. The cows was having mastitis because there's too rich a protein. And I kept saying to him, I says, your problem is you're putting too much cottonseed meal into this mixture. Because I knew what the mixtures was up at school and how to figure them rations. And I knew that that was what was doing it. But he wouldn't listen. Well, he said, I'm making milk. Well, he did make milk, but some of it was, you couldn't use. They had to be separated. But I finally told her. But after a short time, she sold out. She sold, and they were all high registered cattle. I remember while I was there, it was a 2-year-old heifer. And he sold that heifer for $2,000. She was going to back to Ireland. And then there was another, the same man, he was a cattle dealer, or not a cattle dealer, but he had jerseys. And he came to this man, he was, this man Duffy, he knew cows too. And he called him on the phone and said, I'd like to have you go to some auction somewhere in Connecticut there somewhere, and buy so many cows for me. And he did. And that's when he never got out of bed after that. He went, well, he was sick, I guess, in a way, but he never got out of bed from that either. But anyway, he sold this heifer for $2,000. Then he sold another cow for $2,500. And another one for, I think, it was $3,000-$4,000. We had to take them down, and they were put on the cars to go somewhere. I don't know where they would have been shipped, but I can remember them days just as. And I learned a lot. And this Judd was the principal, and he always used to emphasize. Says, learn all you can, boys, at the other man's expense, which was true. And I learned a lot being down there that year that I was down there working. Yeah. But all those things, I got. treasurer. And then after we got back home here, she wrote me a nice letter after that, after I'd come home and was home here, I don't know, 2 or 3 months. But from there, I came on and took over the farm over here.
Yeah, now I should get to, you had,
Maybe I'm taking up more of your...
No, if you're...
5 minutes of tape left on this tape, I can switch to another one if you want to.
Well, you wanted to tell a couple of stories. Are you tired?
No, I'm all right.
You were going to talk about, you had that story about Earl.
Yeah.
And 1929, the Big Depression, getting married in 31.
Yeah.
You feel like doing that?
Yeah.
Getting a little chilly.
And then, you talked about this, keeping up with the times. We have on, you did talk about that. The microwave and the ladder. Yeah. So it's, and then 1947, first ski area in the valley made land valuable. I guess we did talk about that.
Yeah, it did. It made land very valuable because a lot of these farms was taken up.
Are you set there or? Oh, okay,
yeah.
Here we go. So, we've got 1929, the Big Depression, and then 1931, getting married.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, what day did you say it was, the Depression? The ski area.
1948.
Yeah,
47.
Well, of course, the ski area began to come in up here in Facetown. And our town representative was Walter Gaylord. And anyway, he wanted to get the idea of how people felt here in the valley about having the ski area come in, because this Raymond Gadd, was it, Cannon?
Yeah.
Had a meeting. Damon Gadd. He had a meeting called a... Everyone that wanted to come to this meeting down at the church, and he got up and he says, if this ski area goes through, within so many years, there's going to be so many farmers go out of business. In another so many years, another bunch is going out of business. And I sat side of the man side of him, and I kind of nudged him, and I says, he's full of baloney. But by golly, it turned out just as that man predicted, that it made land valuable, and people that wanted to, they sold their farms and for building lots and whatnot. And that's just what happened. And so... When after the son had said he was going to leave and go to cut meat, I felt that that was the best thing for us to do. So I decided that I would do the same thing. So I had the land all surveyed up into 10 and a tenth acres, and I sold it in that size lot. And I had it in the deed that they could subdivide it once, but it got to be equal. It couldn't be, they couldn't keep 1 acre and sell the rest. They could sell it in two parts if they wanted. They'd keep 1 5-acre, but it all had to be equal. And that's the way I've sold all that land, and everybody's been happy. There's just one person that's ever subdivided it. And that's the way I set that up.
And I think you also told me, I don't know whether it was true of all the land, but you also kept the sugar rights.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, when 'Twas out-of-state people that came, wanted to buy land. And, of course, I was approached first to buy the whole farm, but that I didn't want to do. Then they come to me and wanted to know, will you sell me a house lot? And I says, well, I don't really want to, because I says I want to keep my sugar right. I want to keep sugaring. Well, that's not going to be any problem at all. We'd like to buy a piece of your land, and we'll give you the sugar rights. And so I did, and also the rights to cut the dying trees for the wood for the sugar house. So that was the way all that land was sold. I had the sugar rights, and so and all the land has been sold. All I own now is just what's around this house. I think it's 4 acres left now that I own. The rest of it has all been, it's made land valuable. Put a few dollars in my pocket too. But anyway, I'm glad I did it. And at first, I sold that Parma Hill lot. And that was the last piece of land that I ever thought would sell, and I didn't think it would sell, and that was the first piece of land that I sold. And how that came about, I was talking with Anna Whiteside, you probably know her, and she came and says, I says, I'll show you that piece of property up there on a Lowry day. And she called me up one day and she said, do you call this a Larry day? And I said, I sure do. It was kind of a misty day. You couldn't hay or anything like that. But she says, I've got a person here that wants to buy about what land you've got up there. And well, I said, okay, I'll go up. And anyway, I went up and she went around the boundary of it. Next day she called up and Everett, she says, I've taken an offer on that property up there. Well, I knew at the time that I was going to let her have it or let her sell it to this man. But I said, no, I want to think about it. I think I want to think about it. And all the time I knew that I was going to sell it to her. But due time, I called her up and I says, yes, I guess I'll sell it to you. And by golly, he came up and bought the whole lot, and that was the first one. And then I sold all the others here on this farm.
That's